Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Gary Eichen. Today we're broadcasting from the Mod Moon Weyerhaeuser Studio here at our NPR building in St. Paul. Minnesotans this fall will be electing a U.S. Senator. Incumbent Republican Rod Grams is unopposed, so he'll be on the ballot. Independence Party candidate James Gibson will apparently be unopposed, so he's going to be on the November ballot. Big question is which DFLer will be on the ballot. There are six candidates waging an active campaign for the DFL party's nomination. And this weekend at the party's precinct caucuses, they will officially begin looking for delegate support. Now today, all six candidates have agreed to join us here at our broadcast table to give those of you here in the studio and those of you listening on the radio a better idea of just who they are and what they stand for. Last hour, we touched on a number of issues in the race, and we'll continue that conversation in a few minutes. But to begin this hour, we've asked each of the candidates to give us a minute-long pitch on why they are the best candidate to represent the DFL this fall. Now, we should note that two of the six candidates haven't been able to join us yet. State Senators Steve Kelly and Jerry Janicich are involved in Senate business up at the state capitol, busy day at the legislature, and hopefully they'll be with us here momentarily. Meanwhile, let's get started here. Michael Cerisi, Minneapolis Attorney Michael Cerisi. Best minute-long pitch.
Best minute-long pitch, right. Thank you, Gary. I've been saying since I got into this race in October that the overriding issue in this election is a competition between two principles. One, the Republican Party principle as articulated by George Bush, which is, I think, a rather selfish one. Give me back my money. The competing principle is the Democratic Party principle, and that is that there are some things in this country that we do better together. And the most important thing we do better together is to invest in each other. That's going to override every issue that we see: Social Security, education, rural revitalization, health care, making sure that Medicare is appropriate and applied to prescription drugs. Those are the issues that are going to frame this election. And I can am the most effective advocate in this campaign, in my judgment, to carry those issues to the Senate floor. I have said one thing as we've crisscrossed the state, and as you've seen today, we share some of the same beliefs on concepts. We agree with each other on many concepts. But who can be the most effective senator on the floor of the United States Senate and in the Senate office buildings? When I go there, I will be known. The Senate has used our work in the past.
That was Minneapolis Attorney Michael Cerisi. Next up, former U.S. Attorney David Lillehog. David?
Thank you, Gary. I'm running for the United States Senate because we absolutely, positively have to beat Rod Grams. But bottom line, he is only the symptom of a much bigger problem. And that is the influence of wealth and power in Washington, which results in unequal distribution of wealth and power in our country. And because we need to reform the way that we do business in Washington. I'm the United States Senate candidate who's consistently standing up against the special interests. I want campaign finance reform. I will stand up to big money in Washington. I want a patient's bill of rights. I'll stand up to the HMOs who have plenty of lobbyists in Washington. I want to make sure that big banks stop invading our privacy. I'll stand up against the big banks. I'm the only candidate in the race focusing on the trend toward mega mergers in our economy that are harming workers' pensions and workers' rights, and they must be protected. I'll stand up to the corporate polluters. They should pay to clean up their own mess. And I'll stand up to big agribusiness that's putting many, many family farmers out of business and will put the brakes on massive hog feedlots. I will stand up against the special interests, and I will stand up for you. I hope you'll stand up for me at the precinct caucuses tomorrow and Sunday.
Former U.S. Attorney David Lillehog, University of Minnesota physician Stephen Miles. Steve?
You know, every Minnesotan who can hear this knows that at some point they are going to get sick or they're going to become disabled. I know this. I've met you. I've seen you when the health care system financing lets you down. That will be a daily concern with me. Every person who can hear this voice is getting old. I've spent my life in geriatric medicine. I know we have to protect Social Security and Medicare and make sure they're there for your retirement and also so that you're not bearing the burden of your parents' retirement. Every person who can hear this voice needs lifelong education, even adults who are becoming obsolete in a changing technology. And I will work day and night as a teacher for the last 25 years, including raising a special needs kid, to make sure that lifelong education is available. We also need to broaden the professional expertise in the Senate. We need science expertise in the Senate to add to the mix. Thank you.
That was University of Minnesota physician Steve Miles, and now Rebecca Yanish, former director of the Minneapolis Community Development Agency.
On October 7th, 1999, Joan Grow, the former Secretary of State, came to me and said, "We need a strong businesswoman to challenge Rod Gramps." And then she pointed her finger and she said, "And you're the one." And as I thought about Joan's comments, it certainly rang true with me as I watched how Senator Gramps has not represented our state. And I thought of my life experiences, the fact that more than half of my life was in northwestern Minnesota. I'm a fifth-generation farmer's daughter. I understand our rural issues, and I'm committed to finding solutions there. The other half of my life has been in the Twin Cities, where I've worked on more urban issues. I've looked at the contrast between being a single mom earning less than minimum wage to being voted last year as one of the region's 25 most influential businesswomen. I look at those experiences. I know it gives me a perspective to be the best advocate for the people of Minnesota on issues of our rural economy, education, health care, and affordable housing.
And that was Rebecca Yanish. Now, we're going to continue with the format that we followed in the first hour. I ask one of the candidates a question, kind of work our way around the table here, and then everybody can feel free to comment. Let's see. I think we left off at Steve Miles. I guess it's your turn, right?
Okay.
I've heard all of you at one time or another say in one form or another that Rod Graham's incumbent Republican is out of touch with Minnesota voters, and that we need somebody representing us in Minnesota who is better connected with the average Minnesotan. Yet, if you believe the polls, such as they are, he is actually ahead of all of you. And for that matter, Tim Penny, former congressman who was being criticized for being too conservative, was way ahead of Graham's, way ahead of all of the rest of you. So what does that say to you? Is there much support, really, in Minnesota for kind of traditional liberal DFL policies?
Well, I don't think the issue is liberal or conservative or progressive. I think the question is meeting people's needs. And I think Graham's biggest failing as a senator is the way that he continues to put ideology ahead of people's needs. And a classic example of this was when we had those huge floods up on the Red River. And Rod Graham's, in an area that's got maybe a 120-day construction season, leads the Senate on a merry chase about the budget and the census and delays flood relief for 30 days. That's not Minnesota values. Same with the farm aid or farm bill, freedom to fail. So I think Minnesotans basically are people who look out for each other. We are people who value community service. And we're people who say, let's not put a hard ideology, liberal or conservative, but instead let's solve our problems practically. Mr. Penny's high ratings reflected his long career in public service and also the extent that he got an extraordinary amount of newspaper coverage for a non-announced candidate, much more than the rest of us. And I think the papers basically captured what they publicized. Even when he filed his papers, he got front page on the A section. And I think that right now what you're seeing is Graham's is incredibly vulnerable. About half the people in the state want him replaced, and the campaign hadn't even started.
That was Steve Miles. Now we should welcome State Senator Jerry Janicich to the table here. Senator, thanks for coming down, and busy day at the Capitol.
Oh, very busy, very, very busy.
Let me bring you up to date here. We are currently discussing whether or not Minnesotans are really interested in kind of traditional liberal DFL policies. And we began by noting the fact that, in fact, Rod Graham's, if you believe the polls, is actually leading all of you. Tim Penny, who was being criticized for being too conservative as a Democrat, was even ahead of Graham's yet. And So Dr. Miles has commented on that observation. David Littlehog, go ahead. Just if you want to comment, just raise your hand. Give me the high sign, and we'll get you into the conversation. Okay. David Littlehog?
This is David Littlehog, and I'm going ahead only because Jerry needs to catch his breath for a second. Is Rod Grams out of touch? You bet he is. Whenever I travel around the state, I try to drop in on somebody non-political, the fire chief, the head of the Lutheran church, or whatever. And I say, have you ever met Rod Grams? And there's a long pause. I say, well, no, but I met Wellstone twice. And so, yeah, I think he's out of touch. I'm a neighborhood kind of person, became known as the neighborhood U.S. attorney and want to be the neighborhood U.S. senator. I'm not like Rod Grams, who I think is a heck of a lot more comfortable in a TV studio than he is in neighborhoods talking with real people. And let me give you an example. Here's an issue that cuts across party lines, and that's campaign finance reform, getting the big money out of politics. I think as we've seen in this presidential election season, there are a lot of people that are ready to make that a major issue because they see the influence of big money and how it skews wealth and power in Washington, D.C. Rod Grams has voted at every step of the way to undermine campaign finance reform and undermine the McCain-Feingold bill, which would finally get soft money out of politics. So, yeah, I think he's really out of touch with Minnesotans, and that's why most objective people believe he is the most vulnerable incumbent in the U.S. Senate.
Mm-hmm. Jerry Janicich, you want to come in?
Yes, Gary. We all know he's out of touch with us. I mean, he voted wrong on nuclear power or nuclear freeze. He voted wrong on the farm issue. I mean, it goes on and on and on and on. And the only thing he really claims to have done is the child tax credit, in which you almost have to get a refund back from the government before you qualify for that. I mean, in 6 years, he has shown nothing. And I believe the public knows that, and I know Minnesotans know that, because based on our travels and my travels in this campaign, that's what we're hearing. And I am in touch. And I think all people have to do is look at what I do for a living and what I've been doing for a living. I'm the one who touches people of all walks of life every day. And I believe that I'm the one that beats Rod Grams because of that.
Anybody else care to comment? Rebecca Yanish?
Okay. I'm glad Dr. Miles actually brought up the travesty of the disaster in 1997 in the Red River Valley, because I was there with my mom and dad, with my brothers and sisters, as they struggled to put their lives together. There were 60,000 people that were devastated, you know, losing their homes and businesses in that flood. And to me, that's what I thought of when I rose to the challenge that Joan Groh placed in front of me last fall. And it's not only what is happening in that federal disaster, but also the disaster of the 1996 Farm Act, which was called Freedom to Farm, but which many people refer to as Freedom to Fail. So as I look at it, again, it was his inability to truly represent people across the state of Minnesota that gave me the impetus to step forward and to know that I can do a much better job and be a strong advocate for the people of Minnesota.
Michael Cerisi?
Well, Gary, last time I was on NPR, you asked me about the liberal and conservative, and I said when I got into this race, I looked up the definitions, and liberal is someone who is open and receptive to change as the human mind progresses. As we learn more, we're receptive to that type of change, and a conservative is one who wants to maintain the status quo. So I'm a little uncomfortable with labels. I think it depends on the issue. And let me say this about Mr. Grams. I'm not going to attack Mr. Grams, whether he's out of touch. His policies are out of touch. The issues he believes in are out of touch with Minnesotans. The nuclear test ban treaty, the overwhelming majority of Minnesotans support it. Social Security, he wants to dismantle it. We want to secure it and preserve it. Medicare, he does not want to extend it. We do. Education, he doesn't want to provide education for those who are not getting it. We do. It's the issues that he is wrong on, and that's what we're going to carry in the September and in the November election, and we are going to win because we're right on the issues, and I believe that I am the most effective and forceful advocate to bring those issues to the people and to fight for them on the floor of the Senate and the Senate office buildings. That's why we're going to defeat Rod Grams. He's wrong on the issues. Put apart what, as an individual, he may be a heck of a nice guy. I don't know him very well, but he's wrong on the issues, dead wrong.
Steve Miles, did you have a comment?
Oh, I got mine in.
Okay.
I started.
All right. Let's go on to another question. And Senator Janicich, let me put this one to you since you just joined us here.
Congress is trying to decide what to do about the minimum wage, whether it should be increased or not, and there are two competing measures now. One would raise, in the House, I believe it would raise the minimum wage $1 over 2 years, in the Senate, $1 over 3 years. In both cases, the bills contain offsetting tax breaks for business. President Clinton says he will veto the measures. Do you support the president on that? Do you think that, and separately from that, would $1 an hour increase over 2 years make any difference to people?
It's an amazing thing, Gary. This is Senator Janicich. $1. Think about that, everybody. $1 over 2 years. That probably relates to about $960 a month. What do you buy for $960 a month in this day and age? You certainly don't own a home. You certainly have a tough time owning a car. You would think that we would do better. And I believe as Democrats that we should force the issue. And it should be at least $1. I think that it's too little, too late, and that we have to do much better. In this country today, government is subsidizing homes, housing, because people can't afford to build homes. So we're going to pay some people $1 extra an hour and bring it up to $6.15. It doesn't work.
State Senator Steve Kelly has joined us. Senator, thanks for coming by today. Busy day at the Capitol.
Afternoon, Gary.
Wondering, do you have a comment on this minimum wage issue? Number one, is the president right in threatening to veto any legislation that would raise the minimum wage by $1 if it contains these tax breaks the Republicans are pushing, number one? And then number two, does $1 an hour really make any difference in this case?
I think the president is right to talk about vetoing the tax cut tied to the minimum wage increase. I think we do need the minimum wage increase. I don't know that $1 an hour will make a huge difference, but it does set the floor for a lot of workers, and it's important to establish that floor and start moving in the direction of a livable wage. But it's clear that it's not enough in terms of what government has to do, and it's important that we also provide the additional job training, the skill development, so that people can move well beyond that minimum wage and really earn a living wage.
David Littlehug?
You bet I support the president. And for those of you who are listening, imagine a bill in Congress of 114 pages. That's what we have here. Two pages deal with raising the minimum wage by $1, and that $1 can be very, very meaningful to people who are living on very tight budgets and who need every single dollar to get by. 112 pages of that bill contain $80 billion of business tax breaks, including increasing the deductibility of business lunches. Now, isn't that just ironic? People who can barely afford to go to McDonald's and who aren't even making more than $5.15 an hour, the price for that, getting them some justice, is raising the deductibility of going to lunch at Morton's or Manny's. That's obscene. It's outrageous. That's why we're Democrats, and that's why we're taking on Rod Grams.
Michael Cerisi?
Well, I would support the president vigorously for some of the reasons that David's just articulated. First of all, let's take a look at the minimum wage. We just had companies moving out of Minnesota to go to South Dakota because they couldn't hire people at the minimum wage here. There weren't enough people. We don't have people who are trained. They're not educated. So let's start talking about that. But this is the Republican scheme this year. This bill is sort of the watershed of that. And folks ought to understand what's going on. What they're going to try to do is give these tax breaks to the wealthiest people and attach them to these types of bills. This ought to be, you know, you asked before on an up or down question. This ought to be up or down. Are you in favor of increasing the minimum wage, $1 over 2 years? Are you in favor of that or not? Let's not attach all these other tax breaks on it, trying to get your agenda out to favor the most wealthy people in this country. That's where the debate should be. That's why the president's right. And David Littlehug and everybody else who's addressed this issue already, it started with Jerry, we're all right. This is a matter of fundamental equity for people who are trying to move up the economic ladder, and they're at the very bottom of the economic ladder. And that is what this country is about.
Rebecca Yanish?
I'd like to point out, too, in my work on economic development and housing across the state, we often talk about where are the jobs, how do the jobs pay. Well, just in the Star Tribune this morning, major article, there's 44,300 job vacancies right now in the Twin Cities. The sad part is three-quarters of those vacancies pay less than $12.50 an hour. So the jobs that are available that are unfilled are the lower-paying jobs. Why can't we get that base level to increase, again, the amount of wage that can be paid to the people that can fill those jobs? I think that's something that should happen immediately. But I'd also like to challenge our Congress to look at it and say, why do we have to have this fight on an ongoing basis? Why can't we be indexing our minimum wage to inflation so that we don't get behind in where we are in the minimum wage? I mean, we're playing catch up for the last decade, and we're not, even the dollar an hour isn't nearly enough.
Actually, this is Mike Cerisa, we're not even catching up.
No, we are.
Yeah. No, we got a long way to go.
I think Steve Miles, and I think that's exactly the right way to approach this. Mm-hmm. It's not the number of the minimum wage, although I agree with everybody it should be raised, but it's a question of what people need to live on. And I agree with Jerry. The raising the minimum wage, as health care insurance falls, as the employer contribution to health care falls, as we have health care costs increasing three times faster than inflation, is this enough? No. As the need for complex lifelong education to keep up with a changing society becomes ever more intense because our society has doubled its R&D costs and we are changing technologies all the time, it's not enough because people have to pay for this education. As the length of human life is expanding and the time for retirement is increasing and the need for retirement savings is increasing, is a dollar an hour extra enough? No, it's not. And as the amount of affordable housing becomes a bigger and bigger crisis, is a buck an hour extra enough? No, it's not. We have to move from thinking about a minimum wage to the question of our people's basic needs being met with what they are earning in this economy, and think that way.
David Littlehawk?
This whole minimum wage issue is just another indication of the disparity in wealth and power in this country. There are very few people on or near minimum wage who ever make a campaign contribution. You know who does? 80% of those who contribute are male. 95% of them are white. 85% of them are over the age of 45, and 85% of them make more than $100,000 a year. So it's basically the old rich white guys who get their calls returned in Congress, and it's the old rich white guys that the members of Congress are calling for campaign contributions. It's a fundamental structural problem in our system of government. We need public financing, and we've got to take back our democracy and get the big money out of politics.
Rebecca Yanish.
Well, I'd just like to let Dave know that my campaign so far has broken all those rules, because so far at least 60%, 40% of my contributors are women. And I really welcome their coming into this discussion, too, and letting their voices be heard.
We're losing control here. Senator Kelly, you look puzzled and troubled.
I'm puzzled, too.
Well, we do need campaign finance reform, but I was puzzled by the transition because we were talking about something that's critical to the future of this country. Campaign finance reform is, but nothing is more important than how we're going to give people the tools to do better. The minimum wage discussion sets the floor, but unless we start talking about changing our whole thinking about this so that we expect that the folks coming off welfare get a job, but then we don't just leave them in a starting wage job. We start saying we're also going to help you with the skills to move up to, if it's an $8 an hour job, move up to a $10 an hour job. If it's a $10 an hour job, move up to a $15 an hour job. We have got to create that expectation, and the federal government's got to put more flexibility into the money it's already spending so that we can do that.
Yes, sir. All right, let's see. Jerry Janisich.
And Gary, they have to, this is Jerry Janisich, they have to take a role. Currently in Minnesota, we're doing some neat things. We're trying. We understand that workforce development and lifelong learning is about where we're headed. And it's about bringing people into that next wage level. But the federal government, you don't even hear them talking about it. You don't hear Rod Grant talking about those kinds of things, those kinds of issues. You don't hear him talking about that. You don't hear him talking about affordable housing and how that works. You don't hear him talking about early childhood issues. This man is out of touch.
Michael Cerisi.
Well, I'm glad that Senator Kelly raised the issue of welfare, because we've moved a lot of folks off of welfare but not out of poverty. And that's why we need lifelong learning. There's a program in Minneapolis, Twin City Rise, run by Steve Rothschild, which is a unique partnership between private enterprise, the government, and social agencies in Minneapolis. And they are taking people who have been hardcore poverty and are training them to get into living wage jobs. They're moving them up the economic ladder. And that is the difference, folks. Education is the key. And that's why I say this election is about reinvesting in people. We have to invest in our people to give them the ability to use their tools to their maximum ability. And this isn't handouts like the Republicans say. This is an extended hand. And if the government isn't about educating its people, giving health care to its people, then what are we about? This is, if for any other reason, those who oppose this, just look at your enlightened self-interest. It is in all of our benefits to educate people, to make sure they have health care, so that they can contribute to this society. That's our charge, and if we have the surplus, that's where it should be put.
Steve Miles?
Yeah, I think one of the reasons it's not on the table in Congress is because basically the people in Congress just don't have a touch with an aging society. They don't understand the fact that our next wave of productivity is going to come off of the 50 to 75-year-old workers. We've been basically regarding that as a period of decline before you retire, and so we've been tossing those workers out. Currently, the United States is in the bottom 40% in terms of the amount of money that we spend on re-educating older workers. Our retirement policy and our adult education policy is basically written by old guys who need a geriatrician just clinically, but also need somebody who understands an aging society.
Mr. Mike Street, how come you're always talking about these old guys? I mean,
they are old.
If you're just joining
Jesse
us.
Jesse Helms and Strom Thurmond, why throw out 200 years of experience?
But they're young of mind, Doctor. They're young of mind, and we want to keep them young.
If you're just joining us, this is a special edition of Midday here on Minnesota Public Radio. We're broadcasting from NPR's Maude Moon Weyerhaeuser studio in St. Paul. All six of the major candidates seeking the DFL party's nomination for the U.S. Senate have joined us here around the table to talk about the issues in this year's campaign. This weekend, again, a reminder, the DFL is holding its precinct caucuses, at which time these candidates will begin the official process of trying to win the party's endorsement and then the party's nomination. Of course, unofficially, they've been working at it for some while. Candidates include Rebecca Yanish, former director of the Minneapolis Community Development Agency, University of Minnesota Dr. Steve Miles, former U.S. Attorney David Lillehog, trial attorney Michael Cerisi, and state senators Steve Kelly and Jerry Janicich. And by the way, if you have to leave us now, we will be rebroadcasting this entire program, 2 hours, at 9 o'clock tonight, starting at 9 o'clock tonight. Now, before we get back to our issues, Senator Kelly, Senator Janicich, you had to join us late because of capital business, so I want to give each of you 1 minute here. The other candidates had a chance to give a one-minute pitch as to why they are the best candidate. So I want to give you the same opportunity. Steve Kelly?
Or you can defer to us, Steve. This might be...
Well, if they want to say why we're the best candidate, that's not a bad thing.
All right. As Regis Philbin would say, your time starts right now.
Thanks, Gary. This is Steve Kelly. I think I'm going to be the best candidate for the U.S. Senator and the best U.S. Senator that Minnesota could have, because what I'm focusing on is the opportunity that this good economy brings us to fix problems and how we're encouraging people to do better in this new society. That we've got all the changes that are going on. The new economy is making people's lives uncertain, but if the federal government is putting resources into this now, we can do a better job of lifting people up, of giving them the tools for success in this new economy, of ensuring that everybody participates. And we had this discussion earlier, that too many people are not doing well in this new economy. Lots of people are doing great, but it's the top half of the society at best, and we have to make sure that everybody does well. And we have that opportunity. We have the opportunity to make sure that every American is above average with respect to the rest of the world.
Jerry Janicich?
I'm going to win this. And I'm going to win it because I am the best candidate. Why? Because I relate to people. The U.S. Senate is made up of 80 or 85 millionaires. There are no plumbers. There are no pipe fitters. There's no waitresses. There's no secretaries. That's not what that body should be about. That body should be about us. I own a bar. I'm a bartender. I touch every one of you every day. And at the same time, over that same period of time, I've been involved in public policy for this state. I know the issues. I know them like they're the back of my hand, and I know you. In the last week and a half, I've been endorsed by the laborers, the sheet metal workers, UTU and BMWE, which are railroad workers, and today, the Teamsters. I represent you. I represent every one of you, and I can take your message and beliefs and vision to Washington.
Okay. That was Senator Jerry Janicich, Senator Steve Kelly preceding him. And let's move along now. Senator Kelly, China has been making some threatening noises toward Taiwan again. And let us assume for a moment that the worst does happen and that China decides that it will use military force against Taiwan. What should we do?
Well, I think, Gary, first of all, we should, before they do that, be making very clear to them that, that the United States continues to support negotiations between these different entities that are involved in the debate about how to become one China, how to make that a reality. I think that what we've been following so far is this process of creative ambiguity that has kept the peace so far. The United States has to, right now, make clear that peaceful resolution is the only right resolution. If it is, we may have to step in and say that if you aren't going to follow a peaceful path, the United States is not going to abandon the people of Taiwan.
So we would send in the troops?
Well, I think we'd have to examine options. I'm not ready to say right now that we'd put ground troops on Taiwan.
Anybody else care to comment?
Well, this Mike Tracy. I guess where angels dare tread. Here we go. These are the tough issues, and that's why I said when we talked about this earlier, Gary, that we cannot isolate China, because if a decision is made to use force over Taiwan, then you have to ask yourself, what is the exit strategy? What type of force? What type of weapons? What size of troops are you going to deploy? What is your objective? To only protect that island? How long are you going to be there? That is why it is so vital to have economic ties to China, to do everything we can to put these issues that we all care about, labor laws, environmental laws, on the table, farm policy, put it on the table and start negotiating these things and have economic ties to China. We cannot isolate it. It's right now the first largest in terms of population in the world, soon to be second as India goes by it, which is another dangerous area, India and Pakistan. That is why I say that I am in favor of NTR so long as these other factors are taken into account and we have enforceable treaties. We cannot turn our back on that country.
Anybody else care to comment what we do if China decides to attack Taiwan? Jerry Janicich?
Gary, I think if it's about attacking Taiwan and we've gone through all the possible peaceful resolutions that we can, that we best put together a coalition through the UN, not only just us, but through the UN, that's workable and manageable and defend Taiwan.
Well, can I ask you a question? This is Mike Cerisi. Jerry, if you do that, other countries want to have a trade with China. They want them in the World Trade Organization. How are we going to do that? That's why you have to have a coherent foreign policy. Let me finish, Jerry. These issues do not come up in isolation. To simply say that we're going to, at one hand, not have them in, and then go to the rest of the countries and say we want to impose force on China if force is imposed on Taiwan, it doesn't work that way. The world doesn't work that way.
Michael, when we're at that point, all those other issues have caved in. Okay? When we're at that point where China pushes us to that point in Taiwan, then all those other issues have caved in.
Well, I don't want to dominate
this guy.
I'm sure others have some things to say on this, but there is a response.
Well, Gary, I want to amplify on the discussion earlier, because I want to answer your question because it's an important question, but I think we also have to be realistic about this situation. China does not have the military capability at this point in time to mount an invasion of Taiwan. And there are lots of options short of ground troops for the U.S. to intervene and prevent a violent confrontation there before we have to think about sending in troops, because they got to get troops across the Formosa Strait. They don't have a navy that can protect that fleet. They don't have an air force that could protect that invasion fleet. So I mean, there are lots of problems with that premise that there would be an actual Chinese invasion of Taiwan before we get to the question of what the U.S. response should be.
David Littlehog?
Well, this is a serious question and it deserves a serious and straightforward response. I believe there are some areas of the world where our vital interest is so strong that we have to say, yes, we're prepared to use force if necessary to defend those areas. Israel is one example, 51-year special relationship, one of the few democracies in the Middle East. I believe Taiwan is another area. I believe a number of the NATO countries. Another area. We don't have to say in advance exactly what we're going to do or exactly how many ships, planes, or ground forces that we're going to use. But that doesn't mean we don't try to exhaust diplomatic alternatives, but you've asked a very straightforward question. If China tried to invade Taiwan, should the United States intervene and respond militarily? And my answer is yes.
Anybody else care to comment? Steve Miles?
This is Steve Miles speaking. I think one of the things about our China policies, pretty much since the days of Eisenhower, has been to maintain this ambiguity about the situation with regard to Taiwan, recognizing its vulnerability. I entirely disagree with Steve Kelly that China does not have the capability to take Taiwan. But at any rate, we now are seeing both within Taiwan political parties which are insisting on what they call a two-China policy, where they would take Taiwan as independent. And we're also seeing, I think, reckless statements by U.S. government officials to the same regard. I think we should maintain the ambiguity about China and leave the negotiations to proceed. At the same time, we need to communicate to China very clearly that any move against China or against Taiwan would wreck the commercial and political community across the entire Asian Rim, with profound economic sanctions against China in terms of its trading relationships with everywhere from Japan to the Philippines to the U.S., and that it would impose absolutely enormous costs while we proceed to maintain the ambiguities. I think it would be absolutely foolish of us to declare in advance what our intentions were with regard to military force one way or the other.
Okay, Rebecca Yanish.
My only comment, and I think we've just about beat this to death, but I would like to say that, you know, I agree with Steve that my frustration is too often we get to this type of question and we get to immediately talking about military force, an immediate discussion of the United States intervening. I think there are other choices besides the WTO in terms of applying pressure on an international basis to bring others to the discussion to apply force to China to say, it's not just the United States that thinks you're acting inappropriately. Can't we bring others to the table here to do that intervention earlier on and hopefully avoid the military intervention and absolutely try to avoid that with the United States out in lead?
I have another magic wand question. I guess it's your turn, Rebecca Yanish. If you could wave a magic wand, and again, I'm sure you have a long list of things you'd like to do, but first thing, top priority in terms of how to help Minnesota farmers.
That is a really tough question, because with the farm economy, if there was a single silver bullet or a single solution, I know we would have put it in place years ago. And I think the complexity of the issues here just really, I believe it's impossible for one particular solution.
Is there any top priority, a place to start picking away at the problem?
The top priority has to be targeting federal aid to help preserve our family farms. By using $16 billion in federal assistance in the last 2 years, we have worked against our own philosophy to try to assure family farms can maintain healthy rural economies and rural communities. So to me, the tactic is first be smarter about how you provide the federal aid and do it more on an income basis and limit the amount that can be done per farmer. The second issue, of course, is continuing with CRP, because I do believe that's an answer in many areas, from our environmental benefits to hunters, as David had pointed out in the past, and so on. But the third issue that I really think needs to be concentrated on, and comes from something of my economic development background, is do more value added in processing our farm products, so the farmers are not just held hostage to the large agribusiness interests, and that we have a better ability to compete and provide markets for our farm produce.
Michael Cerisi?
Well, I've been addressing this issue since I got in, and I think there are things you can do. The CRP needs to be expanded. It's a threefold impact. It's environmental, it's a sportsman, and it helps the farmers. The interest repayment period has to be extended. Right now it's 9 months. They're hamstrung when they negotiate at the table. Farmer-owned reserve has to be in place. We need to have some international negotiations with regard to international escrowing of land. We can't just do it here in the United States and ask our farmers to unilaterally disarm. 25% of farmers' income comes from exports. And then with respect to value added, one of the problems we have, and as I've traveled the state and talked to farmers about their co-ops, I mean, co-ops are owned by the farmers. And co-ops are competing with the farmers on livestock. Because, you know, you have a twofold problem here. You've got grain and you got livestock. And on livestock, the co-ops that they own are competing. And I've asked farmers, I don't understand this. You folks own it. How can they be competing with you? And they look and they say, you know, you're right. And they've just gotten away from us. So I think that some of this, we have to take a look at how these cooperatives are operating that are owned, in fact, owned by the farmers.
David Lillehog?
I'm sorry, could I just ask a clarification, Mike? Yeah. You'd ask for a single answer, Gary.
Right.
You know, Mike, do you think there is a single response?
Oh, no, why he followed up. You'll recall that Gary followed up at the end. If there is no single response, what are the factors? I've ticked these off since October 15th.
David Lillehog?
Well, there's no single answer, but there's one thing that family farmers all over the state are telling me, and we don't have enough of in Washington, and that is that we need some action against the four big grain companies, the four packing companies, and the three big seed companies that are just dominating the lives of family farmers. Both Senator Paul Wellstone and Congressman David Mingy, two of our best advocates for family agriculture in Washington, have called for an 18-month moratorium on significant agribusiness mergers. I support that. Now, as you hear all these answers, let's remember, while there's some difference in nuance among the candidates, you compare that to Rod Grams, who voted for freedom to fail and is still defending it. I just saw in the newspaper the other day, he said, well, most farmers like freedom to farm, and all we need to do is tweak it a little bit. Well, Senator Grams, your policies have tweaked thousands of family farmers off the land. And one of the best things we can do is change administrations in Washington and in Congress to get rid of freedom to fail and put in some decent agriculture policies.
Mike Cerisi?
Let me just follow up on that, because, David, I agree with you what you said about Mr. Graham's policies, but freedom to farm, when you walk and go around the state, as we all have, and talk to farmers, some of them don't want to scrap the farm bill. They want to change it significantly. They like aspects of it. They like the ability, freedom to plant. What they need is some support with the drastic changes in price. That's what they're looking at. So I think we have to be very careful to say that we're just going to scrap it, because when you talk to most farmers, unless you're finding out something different than I am, but most of the folks I talk to, while they dislike certain aspects of it, they don't want to scrap it. And some of the farm leaders that I've talked to have said the same thing.
Jerry Janicich?
Mike, they do like some of the flexibility in it. But in addition to what both Rebecca and David and Mike had talked about, I think you need to put together a program that allows that small farmer to be able to store their product on site. And you do that maybe with low interest loans, and let them build facilities to store it, so that if the market does go up or down, they're in control of when they get rid of their product. And I believe in our country today, we are doing a great deal of supporting of agriculture. We're just giving the family farm the rhetoric and not doing the supporting there. And I think I agree with Rebecca. If there was one thing that I could do, and you could do it quickly, I'd target where the aid was going.
Steve Miles?
Yeah, this is Steve Miles. I guess I would do two things. First off, we need a fair price so that family farms and family corporate farms can manage their risk during a period of fluctuating prices. And secondly, farmers need to have less encumbered access to both international and domestic markets. I have a lot of ideas on milesforsenate.org, but I would like to comment on Jerry's last idea. I don't think that storing products on your own farm in the context of an absence of price supports or in the context of the futures market is going to offer farmers any additional protection whatsoever. Farmers have ways of storing their grain now, but the problem is that the futures markets in the absence of price supports has just taken them down.
Steve Kelly?
You know, Gary, everybody has good ideas that are a part of the solution. We have to get the loan rate up and extend the time period for loans so there's more flexibility and we do get the price up for farmers. We have to, the CRP can be expanded somewhat, but we have to be careful about that so that it isn't a program for wealthy folks living in the Twin Cities who are getting the money by owning the land absentee. So there are some things that we have to watch out for and make an answer to this complex. But if I had the magic wand, the thing that I would do in terms of making rural communities sustainable, because we've seen this process of people gradually moving off the farm, even in better times of prices. We've seen communities losing population even when we didn't have a farm crisis because there weren't enough opportunities to have high wages in rural areas. We've got to get the telecommunications and technology and learning resources into rural Minnesota so that people have options to supplement farming. That farming, we have all this productive land. We have people who want to be in the farming business. We have to support that. But there are also people who want to do other kinds of work in rural communities, and we've got to make it possible for them to do that. If I had the magic wand, I would make sure that we had the telecommunications resources everywhere in Minnesota so that those communities could thrive.
David Lillehog?
This is David Lillehog. I want to compliment Senator Kelly on his work in rural telecommunications, and my appreciation of his work comes out of my family background. My parents still talk about the night the lights went on out at their farms, the night the REA was there. And government had to do something about that because the private utility companies weren't doing it. And the same thing with telephone service. There are a lot of areas of the state that were underserved for a long time until government said, you got to provide that service. And exactly how we do that may be open to debate, but we've got to make sure that high-speed internet access, which is the next electricity and telephone service times about 10, is accessible to everybody in the state of Minnesota, that we bridge the digital divide.
Okay, more than likely, government is going to have to do that.
That's Jerry Janicich. Brief comments, and then I want to get to one last item before we wrap up.
Rural electrification was an FDR program.
Yeah. All right, Michael Cerisi?
So was Social Security, but what Steve is talking about, Steve Kelly, is rural revitalization, which is what I've been talking about since October. It is multifaceted, and we have to do it. We have to ask ourselves, do we want a healthy rural economy in greater Minnesota? If the answer is yes, we have to help those folks be able to use their talents to the fullest extent of their ability.
Jerry Janicich, I think you get the last question here. Maybe we can get through another one yet. Should the federal government change its laws on same-sex marriages?
Yes. I don't think I need to do any more than that. I believe it should be about commitment, it should be about love, it should be about feelings. Where I grew up, it was about nationality. And we in this nation and in this country have gone through this more than once. It just shouldn't matter.
Anybody else care to comment?
Well, I think the federal government...
This is Steve Kelly.
This is Steve Kelly. I think the federal government should have stayed out of this issue. The states are the places where laws governing marriage, governing unions, governing domestic partnerships are really established. And the federal government jumping in with the Defense of Marriage Act at the federal level cut short this process of the states trying to figure out how to handle this best. And you see Vermont trying to work its way through this. Other states will do this. I think that's the process that we ought to have let go on.
Michael Cerisi?
Well, the Defense of Marriage Act was passed 84-15 in the Senate, so you're not going to get it repealed unless you convince one heck of a lot of senators. You should amend the heck out of it, though. The Vermont situation that Steve just talked about, is that really brings the issue home, because under the full faith and credit clause of the Constitution, how is that going to be upheld? Vermont's laws, and I believe also this is a state right issue, how is it going to be upheld with the Defense of Marriage Act? What we're talking about is human dignity, and it's about time we understand that and recognize it and get beyond the federal government attempting to reach into the bedrooms of people.
David Lillehog?
You know, I thought about this the other... I want to repeal the so-called Defense of Marriage Act, by the way. But I thought about this the other evening with that stupid show on, Who Wants to Marry a Multimillionaire? Got two people who knew each other for about 2 minutes getting married. And isn't it ironic that that's allowed, but when there are so many committed gay and lesbian couples in long-term relationships, they don't have legal rights and responsibilities under the law. Isn't that ironic?
So your answer is yes, too, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. Absolutely.
Rebecca Yanish?
Oh, repeal DOMA. You bet.
Yeah. Actually, the way I look at it is we've let ourselves get drawn into a very emotional discussion. It really should be a discussion of the legal rights of committed couples rather than trying to change certain of our society's traditions here. But really, every committed couple should have the same access to health care benefits, survivor benefits, visitation in hospitals, immigration policy. That's really what we care about, is giving those legal rights back to the people who deserve
them. But in terms of the Marriage Act?
Well, the Marriage Act, to me, you know, again, that's a very personal issue, and I agree with Mike and Steve that it's more of a state issue than a federal issue.
Steve Miles?
The Defense of Marriage Act should be repealed, and I would remind people of Loving versus Virginia. Great name, because it was the couple involved was called Loving, actually, and they were a black and white couple, and they were married in one state, and their marriage could not was not legal in another state. We will create chaos in this country if we allow for situations where contracts are made in one state and not honored in another state. We are one United States, and the federal government should never have gotten involved in DOMA. I think the bill is unconstitutional on its face and should be struck down for that reason.
Michael Cerisi, I think you get the last word here.
That's exactly right. That's how it should be attacked, through the courts, because and Vermont's going to bring this to the forefront. You're never going to get the DOMA repealed. You're not going to convince that many senators to do it. Let's be honest about that. What you do is you go after it on a legal basis. I believe it's also unconstitutional under the full faith and credit clause.
Michael, wasn't the question.
This is Steve Kelly.
Okay, well, we're just about out of time here.
Mm-hmm. This is Steve Kelly.
Very briefly,
you know, our U.S. senator ought to be doing what's constitutional and not leaving it up to the courts to fix the problem.
Okay, thanks, folks. I appreciate it. Jerry Janisich, very quickly. 5 seconds.
Well, Gary, the question I thought was pretty easy, and the answers, I think there were only a couple that answered it.
All right. Thanks so much for joining us today. Good luck to all of you. Really appreciate your
coming by today.
We are out of time.
Thank you, Gary.
A reminder now, those of you listening, if you missed part of today's discussion, we'll be rebroadcasting this program at 9 tonight here on Minnesota Public Radio. Also, the entire program will be available on our website, mpr.org.